Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome everyone to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar Eltzeri, our Senior Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What's on our agenda today?
Earnings. So every quarter, we run through earnings calls, we tune in, we read the releases, and we're currently closing out Q3 earnings season. So we wanted to share some of the kind of key takeaways from the various calls that we tuned into. We'll be doing things a little bit differently this time, because in the past, I know we focused on individual companies and went over their results. But this time we wanted to take a little bit more of a thematic approach. So we'll be covering sector by sector, the key themes that really jumped out from the calls and sharing that with you. So the way that we'll go about this is we'll first touch on the lenders, and it's a squishy group because it's banks and non-banks. But then we'll touch on the traditional sectors, including industrial, multifamily, office, and retail. And then we'll close it out with some of the investment manager commentary and comments from the brokerages. So I'll kick it off with the lenders. And for this section, you know, I tuned into the KKR Real Estate Finance Trust, Fifth Third Bank, Ameris Bank Corp, Bank OZK, and Dynex. I know that's a little bit of an odd group, but I know that's many of the large banks that report at the start of the earnings season probably already had pretty significant coverage, and the large banks tend to not be as focused or as concentrated in commercial real estate. So sometimes diving down to the smaller players tends to be a little bit more fruitful for the CRE comments. So in terms of the first theme, banks and overall CRE credit is really reopening, but it's coming back online kind of carefully. Regional bank commentary showed improving pipelines with CRE balances drifting lower where borrowers accessed term markets, while banks expect steadier activity into 2026. Competition is very real in the CRE credit space. New development starts are scarce, so there are areas where there's just generally less demand for credit. And I would say that in terms of the overall tone around credit conditions and the quality of credit, CRE credit remains pretty stable, or it's seen some signs of improvement, be it there is this still flight to quality assets, and there is a bit of this, I would say, conservative overhang on the underwriting and new origination activity. So asset quality still pretty good across regional bank lenders, and the non-bank lenders who have a bit more flexibility are still underwriting rather conservatively. The debt markets for CRE are opening or reopening, and that's inclusive of both bank lenders and non-bank lenders. KKR on their call noted that debt markets are liquid with banks returning, and they expect originations of around $400 million in the fourth quarter. Fifth Third Bank also commented on the overall origination activity and said that pipelines for middle market and corporate banking remain strong heading into the year end. And then Ameris, which if you're not familiar with Ameris, they're a much smaller bank. However, they have an outsized allocation to commercial real estate. It's approaching $10 billion. And they noted that their loan production topped $2 billion in the third quarter, which was the best since 2022. Underwriting, as I noted, is staying conservative despite the pickup in activity. Bank OZK said that they're passing on about 85% of the deals that they see. They said that the market is very competitive and that they are still just sticking to quality credits. And KKR added to that by saying that as lenders, we think about safety first, lending at reset values well below replacement cost, and they see new supply decreasing. Now, CRE credit as a whole looks pretty attractive on a relative basis. I think that relative value basis theme is one that could probably go for not only the lenders, but also is popping up on the investment side as well. But I'll touch on that later in the call. And while the sentiment was echoed across various CRE lender calls, so was kind of broadly applicable to all CRE credit, inclusive of agency credit. And so Dynex, which is an agency-focused mortgage REIT, called out the attractiveness specifically in the agency space. And they said that agency spreads remain notably wide versus history and most other credit. And they expect compression in the coming quarters and ultimately have increased their agency CMBS exposure. And I know that the capital side of the equation often sets a lot of the trends that impact transaction activity. But one of the key elements that we pay attention to in the quarterly earnings is the operating metrics and the performance metrics from the REITs and other property owners. And Cole, I know that you covered some of the retail REIT earnings. What were you hearing there?
Yeah, and I like to kick it off with the retail REIT earnings because I think these are particularly susceptible to consumer trends. A lot of the calls focus on a number of things that some of the other recalls don't. But what I did here was cover four different companies, and I've pulled a few trends from them. But ones I wanted to call out, Kimco Realty, they reported on the 30th. They're one of the largest owners of grocery-anchored shopping centers nationwide. Urban Edge Properties, they reported on the 29th. They focus on dense East Coast metros, especially in the Northeast corridor. A Brixmore Property Group, another grocery-anchored shopping center REIT, they reported on the 28th. But they also have a number of necessity retailer anchors in neighborhood and community centers. And then Curbline Properties, so they also reported on the 28th, but they're a newer REIT concentrating on small format and convenience-oriented retail. So think pharmacy, net lease, properties like that. A little bit of kind of property type and geographic dispersion there, but I think they had a lot of similar themes. So one that I wanted to call out was that demand is broadly exceeding supply. Every CEO on these calls echoed the same point that demand is exceeding supply by a wide margin. Kimco said only 0.3% of all existing retail stock is under construction. This, by their estimate, is the lowest of any property sector. Even office is larger than that. Urban Edge said that before the financial crisis, the U.S. built about 60 million square feet of retail each year, and now it's closer to 10 to 20. And the result is record occupancy. Most portfolios on these calls were north of 95% full. And small shop occupancy, which had struggled in the aftermath of the GFC, keeps setting records for each of these. The next theme, as the grocery and convenience are really leading the charge, grocery anchor continues to dominate retail real estate. Kimco is highlighting some new anchors, Sprouts and Trader Joe's anchored projects. Brixmore said the same. They've cut exposure to weaker tenants like Party City and Big Lots, but have majorly expanded with Whole Foods, Publix, and Sprouts. Curbline, of course, focuses on that convenience sector, but they had some big leasing velocity this quarter, pushing their occupancy above 96% to 96.7%. I mean, that was among the highest in the entire sector. And there were some redevelopment and retenanting trends that I wanted to call out too. These companies are making big money by reinvesting in some of the projects that they already own. So Kimco and Urban Edge have redeveloped some older boxes into mixed use, much higher yield formats. Brixmore actually reported double digit yields on their completed redevelopments in the third quarter. Urban Edge said that retenanting is their major value driver going forward. All four of these REITs had huge signed but not open pipelines. So huge pipelines of leases that are signed, but the particular stores have not yet come online. So Kimco has about $71 million in future rent that's waiting to start. Brixmore's is about $60 million, and Urban Edge has about 21.5 ready to come online. So they have some big backlogs, and they're looking to lock in some of this near-term same-store NOI growth in 2026, even if that didn't happen in the third quarter. All four firms leaning on capital recycling rather than really any new ground-up development. Urban Edge is selling lower growth assets at around 5% caps to buy 7% cap properties. Brixmore and Kimco say competition for some of their high-quality grocery centers remains extremely fierce. And that's a quote. Curbline's convenience yields are around 6%, but they noted some price that pricing really depends on where interest rates end up settling. So full outlook for retail here. Supply-demand imbalance has kept rent growth pretty healthy. They don't plan on it going away anytime soon. Very little new construction, steady consumer traffic. Retail remains one of the tightest sectors in CRE. They have embedded rent commencements, redevelopment yields that continue to grow. All these companies are looking at solid NOI expansion into 2026. So while transaction volume is fairly selective and they're saying it's rate-driven, investor appetite for necessity-based retail, so think grocery-anchored centers and convenience assets, remains pretty strong. So the retail REITs showing a lot of resilience, a lot of pricing power. Not something I think that we could say just a few years ago, but I think grocery and convenience are really the new kind of core retail real estate. They're taking advantage of the limited new supply and turning it into growth. Now, I also covered the office sector, and you're going to hear a few similar themes here, but I covered another kind of wide range of companies. So I wanted to call out Highwoods. They reported on the 29th. They target high-growth Sunbelt markets in what's a, quote, commute-worthy strategy. It's centered around the business district hubs and cities like Nashville, Dallas, and Tampa. BXP, formerly Boston Properties, they reported on the 29th. It's the nation's largest publicly traded office REIT. They have, quote, premier workplace portfolios in Boston, New York, D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles. Empire State Realty Trust, based in New York City, they reported on the 30th. They operate what is a highly amenitized, mainly Manhattan-based office portfolio. They're most known for the Empire State Building, but they're increasingly defined by a diversified portfolio of multifamily and retail assets as well. And Cousins, this is a Sunbelt-focused office REIT, major holdings in Atlanta, Austin, Charlotte. So a couple of themes from these calls. Return to office momentum is definitely sustaining leasing. All four firms pointed to steady, broad-based leasing demand tied to the return to office. Cousins said that, quote, the tailwinds from accelerating return to office remain greater than the impact of corporate layoffs. Thought that was super interesting. Firms are right-sizing for a hybrid future, but this has still turned out to be a net benefit for Cousins. Highwoods reported its eighth straight quarter of strong leasing. They said tenants continue consolidating into top-tier buildings. BXP leased 1.5 million square feet in the quarter. That was 39% higher than a year prior. They say utilization rates in their properties are up sharply, especially in East Coast markets. And ESRT said the same. They recorded their 17th consecutive quarter of positive rent spreads. And their CEO cited that availability is low at top-tier buildings like ours, and rents continue to rise. And relatedly, the flight to quality is really defining the cycle here. All these companies cited a widening gap between those modern, well-located assets and virtually anything else. BXP says that its premier workplace segment has the top 14% of office space in its five core gateway markets, with vacancies roughly 22% lower and asking rents 55% higher than the broader markets that they operate in. I think those are incredible statistics. Highwoods said that Nashville and Charlotte are very landlord favorable right now, double-digit rent growth and very limited Class A competition. Cousins said that large tenants are continuing to migrate toward this high-quality space in Sunbelt markets. Empire State Realty Trust said the New York market is, just like these others, very bifurcated among the haves and the have-nots, and they say that they're among the haves in this situation. And so bridging off of that, the tight new supply is really supporting pricing power for all these REITs. Highwood said the new construction in their markets is at historic lows. Cousins said the same. They called this de minimis nationwide, meaning that any new projects that they think could compete with their product are more than 4 years away. BXP said that new construction has virtually halted, which has led to, quote, higher occupancy and rent growth in submarkets that we operate in. ESRT said that there is no new supply at their price point in Manhattan. Older buildings continue to be converted to residential use or are just simply torn down. So across all four, this was like an identical theme. Scarcity of quality space in the office market is a huge tailwind for rent growth for all these. And they say that occupancy is turning the corner. Each REIT described 2025 as the cyclical bottom for occupancy. Cousins said that Q3 was the bottom, expecting steady occupancy gains through 26. Highwood says they have a very strong pipeline of signed but not yet occupied leases that should be lifting NOI in 2026. BXP's occupancy rose sequentially in Boston, New York, Reston, and Princeton. Reston is outside DC. Empire State Realty Trust said that its Manhattan occupancy rate climbed to 90.3%, and that was mostly due to strong leasing in this quarter or in Q3 from finance tenants. So signed leases ramping up, management teams are seeing some measurable NOI growth, and they're expecting to see more in 2026. All four of these REITs also discussed some of their balance sheet management. BXP outlined plans to sell $1.9 billion of land, residential, and non-strategic office assets by 2027. They say that about $1.25 billion are actually already completed or under contract. They're concentrating capital on their premier CBD office portfolio. ESRT, similar strategy, recycling out of suburban properties and reinvesting back into Manhattan, but a lot of multifamily and retail assets, not just office. Highwoods, targeting up to $500 million in dispositions and acquisitions focused on high-growth business districts in their markets. So common threads here, less leverage, higher rent rolls, strategic reinvestment in some of these high-demand assets. Collectively, full outlook, I think these REITs describe an office sector that's transitioning away from bottoming out to rebuilding. Demand is consolidating into those best assets. New supply is minimal. Landlords are regaining leverage that they haven't had in some time. And across Gateway and Sunbelt markets, the office REITs are using the same playbook, you know, defend their quality, recycle capital, position for this recovery. So by their own account, the quote, premier workplace is where this rebound is going to start. And 2026, they say, is shaping up to be the year that the office market really gets its footing again. We'll have to see. I know that was a lot. Omar, you covered one of the traditional sectors too. What did you hear from some of the industrial calls?
Yeah, so I tuned to the Prologis, First Industrial, East Group, and Rexford calls. And I would say that I don't think industrial has gone through quite the ringer that office has, that kind of fundamental story and the pickup and turning a corner in terms of fundamentals was a common theme for the industrial space. So on these calls, many of the management teams noted that fundamentals are kind of nearing a bottom as they're seeing more demand indicators improving quarter over quarter. That includes tours and RFPs, as well as gross and net absorption coming in higher quarter over quarter in key coastal markets. Vacancies and rents were pretty flattish. So if we are turning a corner in terms of demand, I don't think that's fully played out, but these early indicators that they were highlighting on the call are suggestive of that and showing some signs of kind of stabilization. So overall starts were also being noted as materially lower in the third quarter. Leasing timing pushed into 2026 for some of the delivered spec projects and sites. But ultimately, the emphasis was really on this kind of rebound. And I know that the delayed leasing activity or delayed decision around leasing was something that was being either spoken to directly by many of these companies in pretty much April through the last two quarters. But that's something that seems to be waning a little bit or moderating a little bit. And then another major theme is that data centers are edging into the industrial space, whether the owners are looking at either developing data centers or doing conversions of their existing properties and equipping them for data center use. But we'll peel back a few of these individual themes to focus on. So the first really being fundamentals stabilizing and demand improving. Prologis said that we see demand improving, occupancy has formed a base, and rents are progressing through their bottoming process. First Industrial noted that touring activity picked up and vacancy was flat versus Q2. This is a potential sign that fundamentals are stabilizing. East Group then said that third quarter improved materially from a slower second quarter, and they're seeing their pipeline growing. And Industrial Logistics Properties said that as a company are working through their 26 and 27 expirations. Another major theme that I noted at the start was that supply pressure is easing and new starts remain muted or a bit constrained in some key infill markets. Prologis noted that their construction pipeline depletes and starts are below pre-COVID levels. East Group said that development starts reduced in the third quarter, given slower lease-up pace. And First Industrial added some good color around their development pipeline for 2026, noting that their portfolio development yields near 7%. On the topic of development, many of these companies are being more selective and their build-to-suit activity is prominent, but they are exercising selectivity. Prologis said build-to-suits will represent over half of their development volume. And sticking on the topic of development, one of the challenges over the last couple of years has been the price pressures in terms of material and labor. But East Group said that they've seen construction pricing come down about 10 to 12%. However, they are still seeing pricing pressure in terms of transformers and electrical equipment. On the topic of demand, development activity and the pipeline is kind of on the supply side. The management teams noted that occupier and tenant decision-making is still slow and showing some signs of macro-related caution, especially for larger properties and larger boxes. Rexford noted uncertainty around macro and tariff policy remains and could impact demand. And East Group noted that converting prospects takes longer for larger spaces, and they're seeing retention around 80%. Rents appear to be at or near the bottom. I think that Prologis had the best kind of quote around progressing through their bottoming process. But another way of looking at it is that the market rent declines are starting to slow. So even if there are market rent declines, they're decelerating. And then in terms of capital markets, the capital markets have been highly competitive for leased products and leased properties. And the dispositions that these REITs have been going through have been quite attractive, or at least attractive exit caps. So to add a little bit of color to that, First Industrial said for leased assets, buyer demand is very competitive. Cap rates are low to mid fives and even sub five in high growth markets. Rexford filled that in and validated those numbers because they sold about $190 million year to date, and their average cap rate's around 4.2% at exit, which they are effectively recycling the proceeds of those sales into share repurchases. On the calls, they did highlight a number of kind of like regional callouts as well. And while Southern California has been a massive industrial market, it's also seen better times the REITs that did have exposure to Southern California painted it as though it's improving. Even though it is getting through some of the challenges now, they do remain bullish on it long term. Prologis said SoCal is improving and leasing is turning up, but they do expect a lag in the near term. Rexford noted that sequential rent change improved. There are structural supply constraints that are supportive of kind of the long-term fundamentals. And First Industrial said that SoCal fundamentals are pointing to bottoming. Rents and vacancy are about flat quarter on quarter. If you take the kind of the net read on the industrial space, I think that the kind of narrative of a soft landing for industrial was coming through those calls. And the reason I say that is because its fundamentals, they are still bottoming. They seem to be showing some signs or early signs of stabilization, and that there is this kind of measured demand improvement that we've seen at least the early signs in Q3, but then the outlooks that were provided by the management teams really colored a picture that, you know, ends 2025 with a continuation of that stabilization and that bottoming theme. I think this was true across actually all the REIT calls around the supply side of just overall, like, new supply is muted, and that's supportive of rent growth, particularly in supply constrained markets. Cole, I know you're tuning into multifamily. What were you hearing there?
Yeah, I'll round out the traditional kind of core four sectors by going over some of the multifamily calls. And yes, you're going to hear some of those same kind of supply constrained themes. But I covered four companies in these comments. So Equity Residential, they own urban coastal properties in markets like San Francisco, LA, DC, Boston, Seattle, your gateway markets. They held their call on the 29th. Avalon Bay, large suburban coastal footprint. And what's interesting about them is they have a huge development pipeline, around $3 billion. They reported the next day, the 30th. Essex Property Trust, they're almost entirely focused on the West Coast. It reported results on the 30th as well. And then we've covered this one too. It's a bit of a smaller REIT, but Veris Residential, they concentrate on the New York MSA and really the Jersey City waterfront, just right across the Hudson River. And they reported earlier in the month on the 23rd, but I thought there were some interesting themes in their call too. But one of the things that was common across all of these, so would say that resilient occupancy is meeting some softer demand, but the coastal markets are really beginning to diverge. Across the board, the tone was fairly similar. Fundamentals are steady, but there is a bit of a softer demand environment as we close out the year. Avalon Bay in particular pointed to reduced job growth and the DC government shutdown as drags on demand. Equity said the story is really about contrasts. San Francisco is leading the rebound with tech and AI momentum, but the LA market is fairly weak because there's been a slowdown in entertainment. Veris said the New York Metro continues to outperform the nation with very limited supply supporting up to 5% rent growth. Occupancy remains high everywhere. Equity's renewals were up around 4.25%. Veris said retention improved to 61%. Expense pressures were a shared challenge. Avalon Bay reported same-store operating expenses were up about 3.8%, and that was mainly due to insurance and utilities. But controllable expenses stayed pretty well managed across all four of these. Another thing discussed on all these calls was the supply cliff that's coming in 2026, if it's not already arrived. And each of these REITs thinks that it could reset pricing power across the sector. So every company talked about this. Equity Residential expects new deliveries in its markets to fall 35% in the next year. Avalon Bay said new stock additions will drop to less than 1% of existing inventory. That's the lowest in more than a decade. Essex said that there might be some new supply in California due to the transit-oriented zoning laws and some new entitlements there, but the development economics just don't seem to pencil out quite yet for those projects. Yields are stuck around 5%, and so you're not going to see a lot of those projects get off the ground. AvalonBay is pushing ahead with their $3 billion in construction, though, 95% funded, below a 5% cost of capital. They're full steam ahead. Now, cap rates are holding firm, but REITs are prioritizing stock buybacks and some balance sheet strength. So from a capital market standpoint, cap rates remain pretty stable, generally mid 4 to low 5%. Private capital is showing renewed interest in some of these properties. AvalonBay sold the Seattle property at a 4.6% cap. Equity and Verus cited sales near 5%. Equity repurchased $100 million of its own stock. Avalon, $150 million. Verus is continuing to deleverage. They're cutting net debt to EBITDA down to 10 times with a target below 8 by 2026. Full outlook, all four REITs see better positioning in 2026. AvalonBay and Equity expect roughly 70 to 80 basis points of embedded growth heading into the next year, along with improved bad debt recovery. Job growth and consumer sentiment are things that all of them are watching, all the management teams are watching, but structurally, multifamily looks fairly strong. Limited new supply, unaffordable for sale housing, and the growing use of AI and prop tech to drive efficiencies across the portfolios. So in short, I think they are navigating a bit of a soft patch today, but in their own words, the setup for 2026 is shaping up to be the best they think they'll have in years. So some interesting kind of common themes there. But Omar, I know you took a look at what the brokerages and the asset managers were thinking, because these are the folks that are closest to some of these deals that we've talked about in some of these other calls. What did you see in those calls?
Yeah, there were echoes of, many of the other sectors. But I would say that one of the key kind of themes that you just touched on was that kind of optimism and the expectation that the coming years are going to be much stronger. And that was definitely apparent in the investment managers and the brokerage calls. So at a high level, if I were putting kind of mashing both of them together, there's been a transaction recovery. It's been real, but pretty measured. None of these are data center specialists or solely focused on data centers, but data centers were popping up on the investment management side as well as the brokerage side as a key driver of activity and excitement. And overall, this is where we've seen some of the most tangible optimism, whether it's the fundraising or actual pickup in transaction activity. But it is, to me, the combination of investment management space plus the brokerages, it became very clear that there is something here. So first, I'll touch on the investment management side. This includes Blackstone, AllianceBernstein, Invesco, Ares, BlackRock, and Blue Owl. On the topic of kind of the CRE recovery, the kind of consensus is that the recovery is real. It's slow. It's been slow, but it's broadening and it's being supported by cheaper capital and scarce new supply, which we heard from the various other sectors. Probably the most tuned into call, Blackstone said that commercial real estate values bottomed in December of 2023, and they're now approaching a steeper point in that recovery curve. So they're sticking with that narrative that we're just advancing on that same recovery path. Another big theme is that private credit and wealth or insurance channels are really being used as a key source to fund real assets, whether that is real estate credit, real estate equity, or this alternative space through various vehicles. This is a big theme that I think that we have probably gone on a rant on a prior episode about this, because I thought this was going to be one of the main themes for 25 and beyond. But on the Q3 calls, what stuck out to me was AllianceBernstein said that they've embedded private assets into their defined contribution glide paths, including private equity, private credit, and private real estate. I think that being a kind of a demonstration of applying and working towards what the opportunity set is was good to hear. Invesco said that their wealth channel interval fund for private credit launched, which is INCREF or INCREF, and it is focused on U.S. real estate debt, and they're scaling that across
their major platforms with about $4 billion AUM. So that was another demonstration of standing a platform up and then putting it to use. Another major theme is that credit quality is viewed as being still sound and generally resilient. This was something that popped up, particularly for the asset managers that had exposures to like alternative credit or this kind of private credit universe. With some of the recent kind of prominent bankruptcies, there was a little bit of a fear that spread. And so obviously this is something that they would talk about or get an address on their call. But when it comes to commercial real estate, you weren't hearing that same type of panic or any sort of contagion or being overly exposed to these defaulting businesses. CRE investors and fund families are certainly aware of the risk that's out there. They noted that they're still seeing resilience within the CRE space and that they are being very selective around which opportunities that they're looking at and which ones that they pursue. Ares Capital said that new issue volumes are returning to a more normalized pace and that they reviewed $875 billion in transactions over the last 12 months. They're looking at a lot, they're being diligent and ultimately being very selective. A number of the calls noted that the transaction markets are reopening and realizations within each of the funds are also picking up. They noted that the bid-ask spread is narrowing on buyouts and that there's been an acceleration in deals under review. And then as I noted up top, that data centers, even though a few of these fund families have a dedicated data center and they have launched or are currently raising data center funds, this broadly as a topic came up on many of the parent company calls because the data center space is just such a huge opportunity. And to illustrate that, BlackRock estimated that there's $1.5 trillion of capital that's going to be needed over the next 5 years in just the core and shell of data centers. So that's none of the guts, really just standing these properties up. And that's being driven, obviously, by the massive growth seen within AI. Blackstone said that with regards to data centers, that returns come from building, developing, leasing with investment grade counterparties on 15 to 20 year leases, and that their leasing pipeline for data center space doubled in Q3 versus Q2. So just a massive growth on the leasing side. And then Blue Owl noted that their current data center pipeline is in excess of $100 billion. So again, just huge numbers there. In terms of the outlook for the investment managers, if you had to kind of like summarize it, I would say it's this continued gradual CRE recovery with improving liquidity and more transactions that they expect to carry into 2026. Again, to belabor the point, but data centers are playing a massive role in a lot of the fundraising and the capital deployment. But for the investment managers, they're able to raise a lot of this capital from another kind of exciting, somewhat new channel, which is that private wealth and insurance channel. And we're starting to see the platforms that were set up earlier this year or late last year really be turned on and put to use. So if that's the investment management side, which had some overlapping trends and themes with some of the REITs, I think to end on almost a positive note is going to be the brokerage and service firms. So these include the Cushman & Wakefield, CBRE, Newmarks. All major commercial brokerages reported exceptionally strong transaction and leasing activity in the third quarter, often setting records for their company histories. So Cushman & Wakefield noted that the third quarter was the largest leasing revenue in the history of the company. CBRE noted that leasing reached the highest level for any third quarter for their company, and that leasing activity grew by 18%. And another clear trend highlighted by the brokerages was the flight to quality or just the overall preference for high quality assets that was coming from the tenant or occupier demand side. This was most notable in the industrial and the office sectors. Cole, I think you called this out in yours, and we called it out in the individual sectors. So I won't belabor those points. But then the brokerages also noted that they saw a strong growth in the non-transactional portions of their business, including facilities management, project management, and consulting. And the brokerages also couldn't help but highlight the growth of data centers as an asset class as well. And they noted that this was largely beneficial across their different lines of business, including leasing, capital markets, project management, and development. CBRE noted that they produced nearly $700 million of revenue from data centers in the third quarter. That's 40% more than in 2024's third quarter. So in terms of outlook, all the brokerage firms expressed confidence heading into the fourth quarter, citing robust pipelines and continued strength seen through October. While activity is strong, the consensus is that the capital markets recovery and property transactions is still in the early phases, with significant pent-up demand from both buyers and sellers expected to really drive this pickup in activity for the next couple of years. I've been talking a lot, so what I wanted to do before we close it out, we've seen some positive improvements across the traditional property sectors from the REIT earnings calls, whether that is either bottoming or incremental continued improvement. We're seeing capital market conditions improve, and the capital sources, whether they're the traditional ones, such as the banks starting to return to the market, or if they're the kind of less traditional sources of capital, including private credit and platforms that are leveraging and using private wealth and insurance capital to deploy into commercial real estate. All of that thawing and recovery is underway. However, this is not a V-shaped recovery for CRE. It is gradual, but we are seeing that continuation there. We are also seeing that commercial real estate is still providing some stability and is demonstrating resilience. We saw that in a number of the sectors, and the relative comparison of CRE versus other asset classes is looking more and more attractive. And that's what's drawing in the sources of capital. Then we also have many of the kind of macro themes, whether that's tariffs and macro uncertainty impacting the industrial space, whether that's RTO and the labor market impacting the office space, or if that is AI really driving this data center boom. All of this is playing out in the commercial real estate space. Cole, what were the overarching themes that stuck out to you?
Yeah, and of course, I've covered the kind of traditional sectors on this one, but we've already mentioned this, but I think slowing supply pipelines across all sectors are really starting to work to the benefit of incumbent owners. You're hearing them talk about pricing power and that translating into strong NOI growth. All of them are finding opportunities to deploy capital or to make deals happen despite expensive debt. And they're fairly bullish on 2026. And you've talked about a few of these things too. Fairly sensitive to some of the kind of consumer trends and the labor market, but they don't think that those are going to fully counteract some of the more positive trends on the supply side for them. But I think ultimately, fairly positive calls this quarter. It should be interesting to see how they round out the rest of the year. But Omar, I think that is all the time we've got. Before we sign off, I'd want to encourage our listeners. If you like the show, we'd love it if you could rate it. Feel free to give us 5 stars on Apple or Spotify. Leave us comments there as well. We'd love to read them. Or feel free to just send us an email. AltusResearch@altusgroup.com is our address. We'd love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. In the meantime, Omar, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.